it was in control of me, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop, no matter what. Like, I don't care how much willpower you've got or how much, I couldn't stop. So I remember getting all these tablets together, and I thought, am I going to get out of this? And I thought, because I just used to lie on my bed, thinking about my wife would have lost all of my reputation, like, because I went from like a local hero to a local drunk. Glenn Catley's opponents pulled out. I says, try and make the fight. I'll fight him next week. You know what I mean? And Terry went, Andy, I'm sure. He says, what condition are you in? I says, I can fight him. I said, I ain't bothered about him. I says, I'm ticking over. I'm doing my road work. I'm doing a bit of... I said, try and make the fight, because I was thinking of the money anyway. You know what I mean? Because I'd turned into a coward then. I wore that big tough guy what used to fight everybody. I was a coward. I was a shivering wreck. Alcoholic, drunken, druggy, alcoholic mess. And I just thought, I hate life. I hate what I am. I hate everything. I want out.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oligo was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beaten me. He's the one that brought you back.
And the paper that made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. Andy Flute is a former British title contender whose biggest fights have come outside of the ring. Years ago, he was a sparring partner to the likes of Chris Eubank, Nigel Benn, Richie Woodall, and he boxed the likes of Neville Brown, David Starry, and Robin Reed. He fought and sparred German stars Marcus Beyer and Sven Otker, all the while suffering with addictions and alcoholism. This was a fascinating talk. Andy also has a book out, which you can buy online at Amazon, called Jesus in My Corner. And you can tell during this conversation that while Andy was once faced with darkness in his life, he has a new light and a very much a new lease of life. Huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here is the brilliant Andy Flute. Andy, this has been a long time coming. I've got to ask you, because follow you on social media, it looks like things are going well now, right?
Yeah, things are really good for me at the moment.
Which you say sort of almost with relief, right? Because you've had some, it's fair to say you've had a lot of ups and downs.
I've had a really lot of ups and downs in my life, yeah. But as I sit here talking to you today, I'm probably... in the best spiritually, mentally, physically that I've been in my life.
What are you doing training-wise? Because you're clearly in good nick still.
I'm in very, very good shape. I still train fighters and I train myself. But obviously because my problem was alcohol, and I don't drink no more. And I mean, so, you know, and I just live a clean, healthy, good life where I never did before.
With what you know now and how you lived the life back then, are you filled with regret over how things went?
I'm not regretful about anything because I'm happy today.
Yep.
And yeah, I should have done a lot better with my boxing career. I should have done a lot of this. We can all look back and say we should have done this. But it's where I am now what matters. And I'm in a happy place and I've found something and I'm doing things that I enjoy doing. And like I said, it's all what's, if you're happy inside yourself and you're happy with yourself, what else do you need?
Do you allow yourself that sort of to drift off sometimes and think, what if, or because it didn't happen that way that you don't allow that?
Not really. I'm really in a good place.
And hey, it's not like you had a bad career either. It could have been more, obviously.
I know I could have done more and I never shared a ring with anybody. Who I struggled with, anybody. And I can truthfully say that with everybody who I shared the ring with, I never struggled. The only person I had a problem with was me. Always the only problem for me was me.
Yeah.
You know, that's the truth.
So tell me about the start of the journey, because obviously we touched upon it there, that you are from a fighting family, your dad, your uncle, your brother, all fought. An older brother as well, right?
Yeah, Stuart, yeah.
So that was that always going to be the career path for you? Were you always going to go into boxing?
My dad was a boxer. He boxed for Bilson Golden Gloves, and he got my uncle into it as well. And then my brother was into it. And then obviously I was the youngest of us all. And my dad used to make, I wanted to go off playing and stuff like that, but my dad, you know, said, come on, come to the gym. So I went to the gym when I was three, and I was round all the boxers watching what's going on. And obviously you're not allowed to fight till you're 11. But I hung around till I was 11, and then I did have my first fight when I was 11, and then I carried on till I was 30 with it, a year off.
Wow.
And then I mainly done that.
When you were 11, by the time you had that first fight then, were you filled with nerves and anticipation for the first fight, or were you chomping at the bit because you'd been so much?
I was chomping at the bit because my Uncle Colin was a professional, and he was managed by Mike Sendall, and they got a good gym in Wolverhampton where Dennis Price, Dino Wallace, Lloyd Christie, Gary Rocky Roberts, who I used to spar with, and all them, there was all around there. So I was mixing with pros when I was a really young age.
Yeah.
So I was ready. And when I had my first amateur fight, I boxed a kid who'd had 6-1-5. So, you know, it was, and I still beat him easy, you know.
Did it come naturally to you, boxing, or was it something that you just did all the time, so therefore became very good at it?
I just did it all the time, and I become good at it, you know, because I was round, like, boxing. I was around my dad, I was around my uncle, I was around my brother, and I was around the gyms. And then my dad was like running clubs and starting clubs and stuff like that. So I was involved in the matchmaking, I was involved in all the bits and bobs that would go with the club. You know, we moved from Bilston Golden Gloves, and then we started Wensfield Amateur Boxing Club.
Right.
And then we went from there to my dad started Tipton Amateur Boxing Club. And so, you know, I was always involved as an amateur.
Because you were known as fighting out of Tipton for a while, right?
Yeah. I'm from Tipton, you know,
And did your brother give you some hidings back in the day?
My brother was my big brother. He looked after me, to be honest.
Did he actually? Yeah. He didn't take advantage?
No. My brother's he's a good guy, man.
And your dad had a scrap business, right?
Yeah, we had a scrap business, yeah. When I got expelled from school, I never wanted to go to school. But it was that easy for me just to go to work, you know, because I never used to go to school half the time. I used to go to work with my dad. Even when I was at 8, 9, 10, I used to go to work with my dad and sit in the lorry, drive the diggers and stuff like that. And I never wanted
paid?
To. Yeah, I used to pay me, yeah, because he learned me values and money.
Yeah.
You know, so when I got expelled from school, and I wasn't bothered, I just went straight to work. And I bought my own house when I was 22. I was okay for money and stuff.
Were you in trouble away from school, or was it in the school? Or did that just come later?
I was in trouble at school, and while I was at school as well with the police and stuff like that, yeah. I've always been a bit of a naughty lad, if I'm truthful, yeah. And I don't care, to be honest. I don't care.
I suppose with where you're at now, it feels like when you look back, it's probably looking back over the life of someone else, a different person, right?
Definitely a different person. But, you know, that moulded me into what I am today.
So you were boxing, but boxing didn't at the time really keep you off on the straight and narrow in that sense, because you were still a tearaway.
Yeah, it did keep me on the straight and narrow, but it did, like, what can I say, it did give me some discipline.
I would have been a train wreck earlier on.
I would have definitely been a train wreck earlier on, yeah, definitely. But, you know, when I had my second amateur fight and I had my first stoppage and I punched the kid and I stopped him, I got him through the ropes, and I felt like I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved the, you know, when he was hurt, and I kept on punching him. The referee had to pull me off him. I could smell blood, and I got the killer instinct.
Got the taste for it.
Yeah, and my dad always said, "It's hit or be hit. Hit them first." You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's which is the opposite of it's the art of hitting and not getting hit. It's the complete opposite. Yeah.
But my dad always said pain is better than points as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. But I get that. You know, my old amateur coach would have been very much the same.
Yeah.
The same way.
Old fashioned, aren't they?
Yeah. And I do think there's a place for that mindset. There's a time and a place, but maybe not all the time and every time. So you had about 100 amateur fights. So tell me a bit about your amateur career. It wasn't just up and down the country. You went abroad with England and everything else.
Yeah, I went to the schoolboys a couple of times. I got beat in the finals. I got beat by Tony Collins. Then I got beat by Alan Hall. But I beat the champions as well. I beat Gerard Walker, who'd won it the year before. I beat Alan Gandy, who'd won it the year before. So I was at that level, you know what I mean? I was at that level. NABCs, I lost in the final to Lee Murrish. And the referee who refereed the fight said, I've been refereeing 20 years, and he said, I've never seen a decision like that in my life. You know, and I won the fight, you know what I mean? And he said to me, I know you've won the fight. But then I started boxing for England then, after then, you know. And I really enjoyed it. I learnt a lot at Crystal Palace. I really did, and I liked the training squads. Kelvin Travis was good, and Kevin Hickey, and I made quite a few friends there.
Who were you on the team with? Who were some of the other fighters on the team?
Robin Reid was on the team. Gary Delaney was on the team. Me and Gary Delaney shared a room together, and stuff. John Irwin.
So obviously Gary's brother Mark will play a part in your career later on. And then obviously so will Robin Reid, but I'm sure we'll come to that.
Yeah. But me and Gary, we used to spar, and we roomed together and stuff, and we used to have a good, you know, the lads on the England team, we all got on, like, sort of thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? We all got on.
Were you a tear away when you were down at Palace as well? A little bit, yeah. Okay.
A little bit, yeah. I used to sneak in the room in the sports bar and have a drink and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? None of the lads did, but I did. Do you know what I mean? And really, I've got to be truthful here. When I started boxing for England, to be honest, and I started celebrating my victories then, because I never drank then, up till then. And then once I started celebrating my victories, boxing for England, I started celebrating by having a drink.
Yeah. You know?
And then when my boxing career was taking off, my drinking career took off as well.
And you were a guy who actually did like the taste of alcohol as well, didn't you? It was nectar.
Yeah, I really did. I loved it. I loved everything about it. And I was hooked from the first few drinks that I had. And
So when you say everything about it, you obviously go beyond the flavour and you think of how it empowered you and how it makes you feel about yourself.
I just liked it, there's no excuses, I did what I did, and I'm not making any excuses, but really, you know, alcohol, for me, I loved going out, I loved the nightlife, I loved having a crack, I loved having a laugh, but I never knew what was going to happen with it,
sure.
You know what I mean, nobody sets out to what happened to me. I just thought it was a bit of a, you know, having a laugh, like just like a normal young teenager, having a, you know, enjoying yourself.
Of course. When you turned pro, what was the expectation? What did you want? Did you think you were going to be a world champ?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I thought I could. To be honest, people used to call me arrogant, but because I could fight on the street better than I could box. I got to be truthful. You know, nobody would have bet me on a street fight, whoever I fought. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that big-headedly. I'm saying that was the way I was.
Because you did do quite a shift on the doors as well over the years, right?
Yeah, I've done a lot of stuff on the doors and collecting money and debt collecting and enforcing and stuff like that as well. I'm not proud of that, and I don't really want to talk too much about it, but I did do that. I was known for my toughness. I was known for being ruthless, and I was known for... you know, if you needed a problem sorting, get to Andy, he'll sort it. You know what I mean? You know, but my boxing career, back to that, I boxed for England a few times. I really enjoyed it. And I boxed for Raymond Garby, who's, you know, who was Cuban.
Yeah.
Good guy, like, really good, you know.
And we mentioned it before, but it's worth obviously just mentioning again that you actually boxed on the same bill as your dad once as well.
Yeah.
So who went on first?
I went on first. I was the first fight on the show, and I boxed Alan Gandy, and he'd won the schoolboy title that year, and I beat him on unanimous decision. And my dad fought last on the bill. And he won on unanimous decision as well. And that was quite a memorable, a great memory for us.
Yeah, you know, I can imagine.
Yeah,
I can imagine.
It really was.
So what did your dad think of you turning pro then? It was just a matter of time, I suppose.
Yeah, well, what happened was I got boxing for England and I went to Germany. I knocked the German champion out in the second round. I knocked the Bulgarian champion out in the second round, then fought Raymond. And I got a bit. There was no Sport England then or nothing like that. And I remember having to get my own train fare back from somewhere once, and I had to pay for stuff myself. And I thought, this ain't no good, you know. And I boxed for England a few times, and I thought, well, there ain't really much else for me to do now, you know. So, my uncle was training professionals at the time,
right.
Because my uncle used to be a professional fighter, and I thought I might as well get professional. You know what I mean? I thought, you know, so. And as I just turned 18 into a senior, I couldn't get no fights anyway.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I boxed in like Seymour Johnson, Frank Eubanks, John J. Cook. Them all good fighters, and I was like a kid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm like boxing men who are really good, and I'm beating them. So I'm thinking, well, I may as well get professional.
Get some money for it.
Do you know what I mean? But I was getting paid as an amateur. I used to box on, like they give me £100 and a trophy. Do you know what I mean? As well. Do you know what I mean? To box on their shows, to top their bill.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And that's, you know, I'm going back a long time now.
What did you make for your pro debut? Do you remember?
No. I think it was probably about £400, I think.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But I sold a lot of tickets because I was a good ticket seller.
Yeah, I was going to come to that. I will come to that. But you lost your fourth fight on cuts. That was always going to be a problem for you. It became a big problem.
Let me tell you something now.
Yep.
I'd a cut as amateur. But when I started drinking in between fights and turning professional, I started cutting.
So I Googled this yesterday, right?
I Googled to see if
there were links, right? Because I had a feeling that we would go this way. And basically, it says that alcohol can cause wrinkles and affect your skin. Mm. So obviously, there may be a link between alcohol consumption and getting cuts. Mm. It could be. But also, you got sharp features, haven't you?
Yeah.
You got square jaw. And there was one fight report as well. Let me just see which one it was in my notes. Not sure where it was, but there was one report in a Boxing News where it said that you looked almost gaunt at the weight. And obviously, if you're that drawn, then you might be a bit susceptible to being cut as well.
That was the combination of everything. Yeah, I think that was when I was gaunt, was when I was fighting Neville Brown for the British title.
Maybe it was.
I was gaunt for that.
So, yeah, it was that, actually. Boxing News said you looked gaunt at the weight and couldn't have taken off another ounce.
Yeah.
But we'll come to that. So, with regards to the drink then, was the, did all through this early part of your career, like late amateurs, early pros, are you more of a happy drinker and a binge drinker?
I was a social drinker. I loved it. I mean, when I captained the England team in Bulgaria, I got all the team drunk. You know what I mean? We had some great laughs. Tony Costello, Lee Rimmer and all them. You know, I'm still in touch with them today, actually. And it was just a laugh, like, you know. And then as I turned professional, but I kept going out every weekend. And right. I couldn't stay in, do you know. And it was just like anybody else, having a laugh, having a good time. Just, enjoying your youth.
What was it? Was it just fun and mischievous stuff?
Just fun, stuff like that. Yeah, just fun. It was good. I mean, I remember... I went island hopping and stuff like that when I was 20, and I'd just gone professional and stuff like that. And then I'd like drink and drink and drink and drink. And then I went to Corfu for 3 months. Drink, 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 3 months. I was doing the door over there, doing lots of stuff over there, and then you come back and then you expect your body to win your fights and stuff like that, don't you? You know, after you've battered it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you can get away with it a little bit when you're young, can't you?
Yeah,
but it
yeah.
certainly does take yeah. a toll. So you lost fight number six to Paul Burton in a fight Boxing News said was close and controversial and that you could have won.
It was controversial. I'd won that fight. I won that fight. There was something to do with boxing for Pat Brogan and Ron Gray between them two. That was all just in the middle of it.
How hard is that then, losing a fight? Because obviously previous, your only defeat previous to that was on cuts. How hard is that, losing a fight when you can make a legitimate case for winning?
But I knew I won the fight, you know what I mean? And he couldn't believe it as well. But, you know, it's one of them. I would never want to cry about over it. You had to just carry on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
And it wasn't as damning then, having a loss, was it?
No, you just had to carry on. Yeah. I had lots of things like that, like setbacks. But what can you do? You can't cry over it, you know, and go, well, you know, you just got to get back on the horse, as they say, and just carry on.
And that's what
and
you
that's
did.
What, and that's what I did. And then within 3 years of being a professional, I was boxing for the British Middleweight title after I'd had a couple of losses on my record as well.
Yeah.
So that ain't that bad.
Yeah, no. So you won six on the bounce after that before you got in with Neville Brown. So you got right back on track and back in the title picture. Mm. What did you make of Neville Brown going into that fight?
I'd sparred with Neville Brown a bit before that fight. And I thought I could beat Neville Brown. You know, and I would have bet him if the weighing would have been the day before. Like them, and them, I ain't joking, you know. But he was a really good fighter, and he's probably about the best of the best about at the time. I thought I could beat anybody anyway because I had that boxer's mentality, you know. But
you sold 10,000 quid's worth of tickets.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
That's an enormous amount.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, Mickey Duff loved him. Because you know what Mickey Duff was like.
How did you get on with Mickey?
Great. I like Mickey Duff. I liked him. You know, I liked him. He put me on the Bruno bills. When I started boxing for Mickey Duff, when Terry Tour got in touch with me, my career took off. Like, it was better. Do you know what I mean? Because I got on well with Mickey Duff because, you know, he made sure that everything was right.
I suppose if you've got a ticket seller who's selling 10 grand worth of tickets, you do make sure everything's right for them, right?
Yeah.
So where did the fan base come from? Is this from you being out and about on the town and meeting people?
Yeah, I was like a local, you know, I was always in the back page of my paper when I was boxing for England. And I was like, you know, a bit of a, what can I say, a popular guy anyway. Do you know what I mean? And I was well known for different other things as well. I used to put coaches on and stuff like that, you know. It was great. I used to get my missus to sort it all out and charge people to get them to pay the coach fare and, you know, pick them up from so-and-so pub and, you know, get the coach, and it was great.
So did you, when Ricky Hatton came along years later on and people were saying, oh, everyone supports him because he's probably had a pint with them in the pub, were you in the same boat as that?
Yeah, it was similar to that, similar to
just
that.
Just 20 years earlier.
Yeah, you're just you're one of the lads, ain't you?
But you must have had like how many tickets in terms of you selling 10 grand's worth of tickets? How many tickets is that?
I can't remember off the top of my head. No, it's too far.
What do you think you'd be selling though? Sort of 500 or 1,000 tickets?
Honestly, I can't remember, but I know it was, about 10 grand's worth of tickets.
And your missus was doing all the legwork
I got her to arrange coaches, put things on and stuff like that for people and stuff. To pick us up, pick them up from. I still arrange it from local pubs and stuff like that.
Was it a stressful part of the gig back then? Because now, obviously, with the way that boxing's structured, selling tickets is one of the most stressful things for a prospect.
It was stressful. I would be out the night before fights, going around people's houses, collecting money and stuff like that. And it was the pain. It's a pain. It was a pain, I'll tell you now. And a lot of promoters today, they don't want you on the shows unless you can sell tickets for them, do they?
No, that's for sure.
You know, but it was a pain, yeah. You know.
Boxing News, though, were very complimentary of you from the Neville Brown fight. And the headline was, Brown learns a hard lesson. And Mickey Duff said that you could actually, even in defeat, be moved into a Commonwealth title fight with Richie Woodall. Mm. Did you and Richie ever come close to fighting?
I sparred Richie quite a few times. But what happened then, I was asked to go and spar with Eubank at this time.
Okay.
Well, I've just fought for the British title. I'd lost gallantly to Neville Brown, which is no thing because Neville's a good champion.
No disgrace.
You know what I mean? And then Ronnie Davis was on the phone to me saying, will he come and spar with Chris Eubank?
Right.
So I thought, yeah, okay, that's great. I'll get some experience sparring with Chris. Do you know what I mean? Mickey Duff offered me a British Commonwealth title fight against Richie Woodall.
Right.
And then I'm sparring with Chris, and then Barry Hearn comes down to the gym to watch me spar because Chris has told him I'm his best sparring partner he's ever had. Ronnie Davis is singing all my praises. I'd done the first week on my own, probably done about 30-odd rounds with him on my own, held my own, and the sparring was brutal, I've got to be honest, but I did it well. And so there I was at the crossroads. Shall I stay with Mickey Duff, boxing for him, and I could fight for Woodall, have a fight with Richard Woodall, or shall I go for Barry, go with Barry Hearn, because Barry Hearn wanted me. So I was like, what shall I do?
So what did you do?
Well, Barry Hearn offered me a lucrative deal, and he offered me to fight in Sun City and everything else, and you know,
as part of the world tour.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which
the
never
Chris Eubank world
well,
tour.
So I agreed to it.
Yep.
And then it never come off.
Right. You well, it never really got off the ground.
So Barry Hearn let me down there really, but and then I wished I would have stayed boxing for Mickey Duff and had me fight with Woodall.
How do you think you would have done with Richie at the time?
Well, when I sparred Richie Woodall, it was no problem at all. I mean, I'm not going to... But I thought I could beat anybody anyway.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
With the Eubank thing, that wasn't your first high-profile sparring assignment, was it?
No, I'd sparred with Nigel Benn when I was 21, yeah. When I hadn't been professional very long. That's when I first met Jimmy Tibbs. And he said to me, God's going to use you one day.
Did he? And yeah. Jimmy's obviously a born-again Christian.
Well, yeah. Dean Powell asked me if I'd go and spar with you, spar. And I says, yeah. I sparred with Nigel, with Glas Campbell. Glas Campbell was there. Helped me on with Nigel, no problem at all. And Jimmy said to me, he said, Andy, he says, you're a leader. This is his words, not mine. You're a leader of men, and God is going to use you one day. And I was 21. I looked at him like, and I went, I'm having a laugh, ain't ya? I said, you're having a laugh. He said, listen, son. He said, I'm telling you, and I like Jimmy. He reminded me of my own dad. He was a no-nonsense guy.
Yeah.
Straight.
Yeah.
And I liked him. And he said to me, he said, will you come to a church with me tonight? He said, I'll pick you up. And I said, I'll take you to a church. And I said, and I just said, yeah, okay. Just to keep him happy. You know what I mean? But I had no intent, like, listening or anything else.
Didn't know where
it
was going. Yeah,
You know, and I just went with him. And that was it. Carried on sparring with Nigel, done what I got to do, and then went our separate ways.
So what was that sparring with Nigel like then? You just turned pro.
I just turned pro. I was in awe of him a little bit, you know what I mean?
Did he stick it on you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they all do, don't they? When the press is there and everything's there, you know what I mean? They don't take it easy. None of them do. You know what I mean? You know that yourself. You know what I mean? You know, and they all do. So you've got to be able to defend yourself and hold your own, yeah. which I could, you know, which I could. And I really enjoyed it because it was giving me a taste of top level boxing.
What was the difference between being a sparring partner for Ben and a sparring partner for Eubank? What was the difference?
There were a lot of difference. There was both brutal, to be honest. I've done more with Chris, and I've done more with Chris, and I was a more seasoned professional.
When I done more with
Chris.
And Nigel, did you do some abroad?
I done an exhibition fight with Nigel as well.
Yes.
And he went berserk and tried to knock me out because somebody had spread rumours on social media, which it wasn't me, that I was going to try and knock him out, and I didn't. So when I went to the middle of the ring with him, he went, knocked my hands and looked me in the eye, and he says, I've heard everything you've said about me.
And this was in your 40s, right?
Yeah, he was a couple of years older than me, and I was 42. And I thought, oh, man, here we go now.
Flashbacks to sparring sessions. Did you enjoy the sparring sessions? And when you were sparring the likes of Chris and Nigel, were you thinking, well, you know, these are going to be harder than my fights?
I can truthfully say I held my own all the time.
Yeah.
I never struggled. But you know what? I drank every night. I had a few pints of beer every single night. Ronnie Davis couldn't believe it. He said, Andy, why don't you stop drinking and knuckle down with your boxing? I said, Ron, I'm doing my job, ain't I? I said, if I don't do my job, send me home. Do
you know.
Was it just pints of beer by this stage? It was just shots and that as well.
It was like 10 pints stuff then. I mean,
so were you stinking of booze in the ring the next day? Was
now what I used to do? I did spar hungover a couple of times. I did, but I managed to do it. I don't know how I did it, but I did it because I got used to it. Because, you know, I was just like, I just got used to it. It was just like water off a duck's back. I was drinking every night, but I could still out my own sparring as well.
So you do maybe 10 pints one night and go and spar the next morning?
What I used to do, I'd get up early in the morning, run to the pier, run back down, have my breakfast and go to bed. And then by the time 3 o'clock come to spar with Chris, because Chris always sparred at 3 o'clock,
right.
I'll be ready, I'll be okay.
And then you'd spar and then go back out?
And then I'd spar and then just go back out. And you, I mean, I've seen you talk to Ron. Ron's told you, ain't he? But what I was like, you know, I don't urge anybody else to do it because it's wrong. I wish I would have knuckled down. You know what I mean? And took it more serious.
But your story's your story, isn't it?
Yeah. Then I probably would have done better. But you know, I don't. I enjoyed what I did. I enjoyed the nightlife everywhere I went. On every sparring job I went on, I went out. And on every, that's what I did. I really enjoyed it. When I went up to Leeds, spar with Emmy Warren, I enjoyed it. I went all around the town, Leeds, spar with Errol Graham, around the town, sparring around Sheffield, to Germany, Frankfurt, Cologne, everywhere. I went out everywhere I went. And I went all around the pubs, all around the bars, or everywhere I went. And I really enjoyed it.
I'll come to some of those names in a bit. So you rebounded from the... Neville Brown loss with a win against Graham Burton, that then lost on a show to Carlos Christie. He was 9-17-1. What happened in that?
Carlos Christie couldn't hold his own with me in the gym, and he caught me on a bad day. And then he beat me again because I hadn't recovered. What happened was, if it's a long story, this is, but I took some sugar drinks. When I started sparring with Nigel Benn had an energy shot before he got in the ring.
Right.
And it was called a superbolic fix. It was like a little ampoule and it was in a shot. And I got me some of them and I used them and they was great. But then they stopped making them.
Right.
And I thought, I need someone else. But obviously I didn't, but I did. But I thought I did.
Yes.
So I went off. So.
Talk about placebo effect.
Yeah, I thought I needed an energy drink. So when I weighed in to fight Carlos Christie, I never drunk no water. And all I did was drink sugar drinks, carbo force drinks.
Yeah.
So by the time I got in the ring of the night, I was dehydrated. I got nothing. I was flat. And he loved it because he couldn't believe it. Because he could see that he was only there for the, you know, two or three rounds at the most, four rounds. Because in the gym, he couldn't hold his own over nobbies. You know what I mean? But he could see that I was gone. That I was flat, that I was got nothing. And so, fair play to him, he won on the night.
So you had three wins after losing to Christie, but then you had one of the worst runs in terms of big names that I've seen in quite a while. Like in terms of, you had a horrible run of foes. We'll kick it off with, obviously we mentioned Mark Delaney, that's for the WBO Intercontinental. You lost a 12-rounder. Did you know you could do the 12 rounds?
Yeah, now I could have beat Mark Delaney, no problem, they knew that. But a lot of people don't know that. They put the fight on, called it off, to do it on purpose. Because I was training with Dean Powell down the Peacock. I was staying in the Bridge House Hotel and I was paying out, you know, for my own. I was training with Bruce Scott, Wayne Alexander. I was sparring with Chris Poyet, Chris Oko. And I was sharp, I was good. So... they sent one of their guys down to the Peacock Gym from Matchroom to watch me spar, and then they called the fight off. Do you know what I mean? So it's tactics.
And then you took your foot off the gas.
So then they put it on again.
Yeah.
So I went down again, and I sparred, and I done good again, and they called it off again. Do you know what I mean? Now that's, you know, that's tactics, fair enough. And then they put it, then I should have pulled out myself then, because by the time I did fight him, I was just flat. I'd overtrained, and they knew what they was doing. I told Mark Delaney. I met up with him not long ago, and I told him.
How are the Delaneys doing, Mark and Gary?
Yeah, they're not bad. I went down to West Ham not long ago to the boxing club to do a talk. Benny Stafford asked me to go down.
Is Gary out at the minute?
Yeah, I think he's out now, yeah, because Benny got a book for him off, got one of my books for him to give him.
Because Gary did time for someone hitting the deck hard on a pavement, didn't he? He hit someone. And
that's just unlucky, that is, because we've all done that. You know, and I think that he was working at Stringfellas. I've worked the doors, I've hit people, they've gone down. You know, luckily enough, they've got up. He was just at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Cracked the head and that, you know, was it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I feel sorry for him, to be honest.
Robin Reed, you lost in the 7th of 8. How good was Robin? You noticed a big improvement from when you knew him as in the amateurs to when you fought in the pros.
Me and Robin, we went to Germany to box. He was light middle, I was middle. Gary was light heavy. When we was at Crystal Palace, I don't think he was all that, to be honest. But you know what, when I fought him, he'd made a massive improvement. You know, but I only took the fight to 2 weeks' notice. The fight was in Glasgow on the same bill as Nassim Ahmed. I thought, I don't even need to be that fit to beat him. You know, I drove all the way up there. They asked me if I wanted to go up the night before. I says, I don't need to. I could just drive up there and fight him and beat him and come back. But when I got in the ring with him, he was a different... He was sharp, he was good, he'd really come on a lot, and he was good. He won the first couple of rounds. At the third and fourth, fifth round, I come into it, but my face started to swell up, and the ref stopped it.
He could really punch as well, Robin.
Yeah, he never knocked me off my feet or nothing like that. Nobody ever knocked me off my feet.
But you could feel he could crack.
Yeah, but he was somebody else, man. He was good. He really surprised me. And I take nothing away from him. He was really good that night.
So Robin sent me this yesterday, actually, which you might get a kick out of. He says, tell Andy I said hello and all the very best, as our fight helped in my career in becoming a world champion. So I thank him and have the utmost respect for him and all the very best.
Yeah. He used to say, I'm as hard as nails.
That's factual, right?
Yeah, he said because he hit me with everything.
Well, that was it. So Claude Abrams covered that fight ringside for Boxing News, my predecessor at BN, and he said that you soaked up a lot of big shots and kept coming forwards.
I did, yeah, I did, and I took him and I come back and I won. I think I won about a couple of rounds then, and Robin was looking a bit disillusioned, but then he stepped on the gas again, and obviously because I'd only had 2 weeks' notice, I hadn't got the engine to go with him, like, and my face was swelled up bad as well.
So tell me about where you are in your mindset of your career now. Are you still ambitious and thinking I'm going to be a champion? Or after losing to Brown, Delaney, Robin Reed, and then taking these sparring assignments, are you starting to think I'm more of a gatekeeper?
Yeah, well, the thing is with me, money was my god.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? The thing is with me, I never turned nothing down, even if I was fit or unfit. If they asked me to go and spar with anybody... If I was, I don't think they're going to say, go and spar with Nigel Benn or Carl Zaki or Eubank. And don't forget, I was drinking all the while then as well. You know what I mean? But I just used to say, ask him how much and I'll do it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, what dates and how much?
And I'll be there.
Yeah.
And Terry Till used to phone me up to book me flights to Germany and stuff. And I never used to think, who it is or overruled by anybody. I just used to go, how much, I'll do it.
What were you being paid by? Were you being paid a day rate?
Sometimes it was day rate, sometimes it was more, you know what I mean?
So, like, because, you know, obviously a day rate, does that mean that you'd have to do 6 rounds a day?
Yeah.
Or you paid for 50 rounds in total? Yeah. Like, how does it work out?
They never really discuss stuff like that, but you would always have to probably do six rounds a day, 2-8 rounds a day.
So they'd say...
They just expected it.
Yeah, so what I'm getting at is, do they just pay you a lump and say, look, here's X hundred or X grand and just come and be at our disposal for 3 weeks?
No, they just pay me after. And they, I've never done low less than 4 rounds.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But then the first day, some places you can just get away with 4 rounds. Do you know what I mean? But we're like the Germans, they want their money's worth out of you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so pass you around the gym and do
you know
that.
What I mean? Yeah. Because like I used to spar with Marcus Bayer, stay in and put 7 Odker in and I'd stay in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I don't.
Yeah, and you spar Rudiger May as well, right?
Yeah, but I did. But I just did it. I did it. No problem at all, because you know you can either just go into sparring partner mode, like where you just get through, just get behind your jab, and you know.
Did you take any sparring mentality into the prize ring with you at all? Was there a point where it carried over where you were?
Towards the end, yeah, because I wasn't bothered when I fought David Story. When he went for the money to help pay for my wedding, I wasn't interested in winning or nothing. You know what I mean? I wasn't interested at all. You know what I mean?
When you fought Southpaw Norbert Nairova in Germany, you lost in the fourth of eighth.
Yeah, he cut my head. My head cut.
So you got cut again.
I got cut on but it was on my scalp, and the blood was rushing into my face. Henry Mask was top of the bill. It was a big show, that was. You know what I mean?
What was the worst cut you had in your career? Was there one that stood out, or were there?
Well, this is just what this. Well, this is where look. This is what I'm going to say to you, because I boxed for Ron Gray, right? I boxed it early in my career. I'd done 8 2-minute rounds against Carl Barwise, right? And then with 24 seconds left in the eighth round, I'd won the fight. Referee John Cole stops the fight. So I don't need no stitches, and they stopped the fight. I had 3 butterflies on it, and they don't stop the fight. Okay? Then I boxed for Ron Gray again on a Canuck show, and I boxed a guy named Richard Okuma. I don't know if you know him, but he was All African Games gold medalist, and he was a tough kid, big tall kid, and he was 6'4". And I had 7 stitches down here after the fight and 9 stitches down the other one after the fight. And my dad wanted to pull me out after round 4, and I wouldn't let him. So I had the cuts down there, and the day stopped the fight, and I drawed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because when I was doing my homework, you got cuts everywhere. It wasn't just the same cut reopening. There was one where it said you had a diagonal gash across your forehead.
Yeah, I had to go to Harley Street to have that one done, because the doctor stitched. I let the doctor stitch it up on the night, and he stitched it up incorrectly.
Right.
And I had to go to Harley Street and have that done as well.
You mentioned, obviously, the Carlos Christie rematch there. You fought him for the Midlands title
I hadn't recovered from the first fight. I went to the PATH lab at Wolverhampton, and I had my blood tested, and I'd got urea in my blood, right, which is caused by too much excessive muscular load. I'd overtrained, and I wore right. So he had been over me again.
And then you had these back-to-back fights in Germany, 2-0 Marcus Beyer and a 3-0 Sven Otker fighting back-to-back world champs. Guys, had you already sparred them by that point, or did you go back and spar afterwards?
When I fought Beyer, I got to Austria, and I was like 6 pound overweight, and so I had to get in the sauna because they was going to take money off me. So I lost the fight in the sauna. You know what I mean? But he didn't give me no trouble at all. And then they asked me to fight Sven Otker. And you know what? Steve Oldsworth commentated on that fight. And I won the first round. And I was there to win. And I would have beat Otker. But you know what? The referee took points off me to knock me out of my rhythm. You know what I mean? And Steve Oldsworth was complaining. He was going, that ref, that he's cost Andy that fight.
Did you think they could go on to do what they did, Beyer and Otker, or did you rate them
that? I don't rate them that much, to be honest. They was just like fit and busy, like, you know what I mean? But I had my own back on Beyer. I knocked him out in the gym after. I put him down.
Over there?
Yeah, and they stopped the sparring and they never put me in again. And I got paid for the week in full. But I thought out of the two, Otker was the better. He was the busier. He was the better.
After the Otker fight in Germany, you had almost a year out of the ring. Were you retired, or were you going off the rails?
I was going off the rails then. I'd say I was alcoholic by then.
Really?
Yeah.
So tell me then, what was the transition from going from binge drinking to alcoholism? And was there a moment where you're like, you know, where the enjoyment became a sort of desperation?
Well, I was just going out all the while, to be honest, and I was enjoying it, and I was into all sorts of criminal stuff as well. I'm not proud of all that, but I earned a lot of money in other things, stealing lorries, all sorts of stuff like that, you know. So I was in that sort of lifestyle, in that sort of environment, and stuff like that. And then I bought a pub as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I bought this pub and I was a free ass at this pub. And then I opened another business on the side of the pub, which I started selling beer to other pubs. And it was very, very lucrative. I was to buy like hundreds and hundreds of barrels of beers and sell them to like 50, 60 pubs in the local area. It was a separate business and I was making a fortune. So my boxing then was suffering. And by the time then I'd got loads and loads of money. And I used to think to myself, well, I've got loads of money. I don't need to give me boxing the best now. I ain't that bothered. Mm. You know what I mean? And that's what, because money was my God then. Do you know what I mean? You know, I was much interested in money, to be honest.
So that criminal activity and the stuff that you've alluded to, did you get in any trouble for any of that stuff?
Some of it I did, yeah. I had my doors kicked off at my pub and stuff like that.
By the feds?
Yeah. I don't really want to say too much about it, but I was into everything. You name it, I was into it. You know. And
why was that? Because you could?
Because I could, and I knew them sort of people,
yep.
You know, and I knew them sort of people, and that's what I did. Like I said, with the debt collecting and the things like that, and the money things and stuff, what we did, I had a fair amount of people around me, and a lot of criminals and stuff like that. You know, I remember the one time, the one lad, we stole this lorry, and the lorry driver stabbed him. I don't know if you've seen it on the news, and he stabbed him in the leg, and then he was got this Subaru car trying to drive him to the hospital, and he died on the way because the Greek lorry driver had stabbed him, and that was because of a slot that was. You know what I mean? And he died because of, you know,
yeah,
loss of blood.
You worry about how that stuff and that life might affect your boxing career? Because
at that time, I wasn't really that bothered at my boxing career, to be honest. They'd offered me fights. Nobody would give me no notice. This time we're talking about now, nobody would give me no notice for a fight.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? No, nobody would.
Yeah, I did read about that. There was a period for you where it was frustrating that where people would give you fights, but it was only be like, right, what are you doing on Saturday?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
No notice.
Yeah, because they knew. I mean, they knew I was an handful for anybody if they give me notice.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Brian McGee, they give me a bit of notice, then they cancelled.
So the Sven Otker thing, when you lost to Otker, did you, and you didn't box for nearly a year, were you retired or was it just...
No, I wasn't retired, but I was busy doing everything else.
Yeah.
You know, I'd had...
Were you training? Did you tick over?
I've always ticked over, but like I said, I was like a functioning alcoholic. I was just drinking all the time as well. And the lifestyle that I led, the criminal lifestyle that I led, all went in hand with everything I did. And then I had some children as well then, you know what I mean? And I'd bought a couple of houses and stuff like that. And so boxing was coming, like, you know, last sort of thing.
Did you gamble?
Yeah, as well, yeah.
Were you big into that?
Yeah.
How big? how the reason I ask is just addictive behaviours and stuff.
Yeah.
How big was that, and when were you in? When was that the worst?
Or
when
gamble. I used to gamble a lot. You know what I mean? Gamble. Yeah, I put $5,000 on one horse. You know what I mean?
Did you lose?
Yeah.
And I'm guessing you weren't making that for a fight back in the day.
Look, like I've said, I did what I did, and I mean,
The money was there.
Yeah.
Were you gambling on everything or just horses?
No, just horses.
Because you knew a bit about horses.
I own horses. I have got horses. I've got still now. Yeah, I've got a yard. I've got stables, and I bought some greyhounds as well. And I started racing greyhounds.
So you're feeding them at the addictive machine, right? Non-stop.
It was great at first. This greyhound trainer who I knew, he said, Andy, he said, I got some great dogs. He says, what are you? He says, come over the track, over Penny Bar. He said, and have a look. He said, and, you know, but he was trying to get me to buy some dogs.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So I went over with my mate, John Dibble, and he gave us a few dogs to bet on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I put a couple of hundred quid on each dog and they all won. So like I thought, man, this is easy. Do you know what I mean? So therefore I goes and buys some greyhounds with him. Do you know what I mean? So
logical move.
Yeah, because I thought, this is easy, this is. Do you know what I mean?
Were yours any good?
Pardon?
Were yours any good?
But we won some, we lost some. You know what I mean? Yeah, but yeah. But I kept a book on it, I did. You know what I mean? I kept a book on it. And then I went in partnerships with this one kid named Dave Mead. I kept a book on it. Then when I got down to breaking even, I said to him, Dave, you got to buy me out now. I said, I've had enough. You know what I mean? And he said, Andy, he said, I'm buying a couple of racehorses. Do you know what I mean? He says, will you want to come in on with me with that? I said, I'll have a think about it. But I'd already got trotting horses myself because I'd already raced on the track, trotting right. horses, because I got a jockey's license for trotting, harness racing and stuff like that. And then my brother lives on a gypsy site. And then we was racing the horses on the road as well.
So how come your brother, I don't get that. Because your brother's not a traveller, but he...
No, but he married a gypsy woman.
Ah, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so he was lives on a gypsy side.
Sure.
And he's got about 50 horses still now today.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a diverse life, you know, you're crossing a lot of different sections of the community here in terms of horses, gypsies, crime, boxing.
Yeah, yeah.
Spinning a lot of plates.
Yeah, yeah, I did. I've had a colourful life, to be honest. I really have. I've seen.
Are you enjoying it at this point? I've seen a lot of things. When you're going out and you've got this life and you're gambling and you're drinking, are you loving life?
I was happy then. It was okay.
What about drugs? How big a part were drugs at this point?
I remember boxing Robin Reed, right, and I'd still got black eyes, and I went out and I had a fight. And I got stabbed and nearly died.
Where did you get stabbed?
In the back. 3 times in my back. Just missed me lungs. I had a right fight, like a cowboy fight. I was lucky to get away with my life, to be honest. No man.
So was that fight someone coming to...
It was just a gang fight.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So were you around through the... Steve Foster times of...
He was a bit before me, wasn't he?
Steve Foster McCracken times.
Yeah,
that was
a bit before me.
But yeah, I mean, not necessarily as a fighter, but in terms of in the peripheries of the boxing community and...
I don't really come across them. I don't really come across them at all.
Yeah.
You know.
I just wondered, obviously, if there was like that hand-in-hand sort of stuff.
Yeah, but I was enjoying myself, yeah, everything I was doing, yeah. The drugs, yeah. I used to take cocaine to just help me stay out. And then I got into selling it and stuff like that. But you know what? Like me, like you said, I got an addictive nature. I'd sniff an whole gram of cocaine in one go, and then I'd sniff a bottle top of tequila up the other nostril just to show off. Yeah. That's crazy, eh?
So, you know, when you're home, I'm assuming that you were going home, but at 5 and 6 a.m. and you can't sleep and stuff. Did you get to the point where you enjoyed that come down? Or was it?
No, I could handle it. But what I used to do was go out of a Friday and not come back till Monday or Tuesday.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So what state would you be on a Monday or Tuesday?
I'd just be all right. You know what I mean? I'd just carry on. Yeah, I'd just be all right. You know what I mean? I used to drive all around. We used to go to nightclub in all places all around the country. We used to go to Bristol. We used to go everywhere, Nottingham and everywhere, and then come back to Birmingham at night, then go somewhere else. I used to have a brand new Land Cruiser, and we used to drive everywhere, everybody in it, and just party, party, party.
You had no idea that you had a problem like that?
Well, I never knew I was going to end up like I did. You know what I mean? Because I thought I could stop at any time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that was it. I was just enjoying myself.
After that Otka fight, obviously we talked about you having the pause, you know, nearly a year. You came back and you beat Romanian Octavian Stokia. You won 3 in a row. Did that feel like a new start?
Well, I wanted to be honest, then I wanted to. I boxed that Octavian guy, and you know what? I cut again. But it just shows, you know, the ref day stop you. Do you know what I mean? I was really bad cutting that. You know what I mean? And the day stop you. And then I boxed Darren Littlewood. And then I beat him easy enough. But then I fought Errol MacDonald, which was a good, good win.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because he just knocked Bobby Bangor out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he was unbeaten. And I demolished him, I did. You know what I mean? And I should have had another title fight after that. because other people beat him and they had title fights and I never did.
So after those three wins, when you came back, you were matched with Glenn Catley. Was that a late notice gig? So that came about. I think I remember now. So Calzaghe was going to fight Sid Vanderpool, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And then that show crumbled and they hastily got this show together, which had you and Catley on top.
Yeah. But this is how the Catley fight come about. I read the boxing news on the Friday. I picked the boxing news up on the Friday and I looked and I read it, that Glenn Catley's opponent has pulled out.
Right.
So I got on the phone to Terry Toole on the Friday and I was ticking over, you know what I mean? And I said to Terry, Glenn Catley's opponent's pulled out. I says, try and make the fight. I'll fight him next week. You know what I mean? And Terry went, Andy, I'm sure. And she says, what condition are you in? I says, I can fight him. I said, I ain't bothered about him. I said, I'm ticking over. I'm doing my road work. I'm doing a bit of... I said, try and make the fight because I was thinking of the money anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As well. And Terry rings me a couple of days after. He goes, Andy, I've made that fight. So on the Monday, I get on the scales and I'm like 12-10, 12-12. Do you know what I mean? So on the Saturday, I've got to be 12 stone.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But I took the fight, week's notice. Done okay, got cut. Nobody's on, nobody's there, you know what I mean?
Were you sober through that week?
No. No, still had a few points every night. I always did. I mean, I always did. It was what I did. You know what I mean?
How are you able, because obviously there's a lot of calories in booze.
Yeah,
how are you able to stay in such good shape?
Because I've done a lot of running, man.
So you just ran it all off? So you must have had to be running miles and miles.
Yeah, I've done a lot of running, you know what I mean? I did a lot of running, sweatsuit on, done a lot of running. That's what lost me the fight with Neville Brown, because I run in the morning to make the weight.
That fight with Catley, I think Glenn was 23-3, and then literally hit that win over you was his springboard into his incredible run where he beat Eric Luca and Marcus Byer.
But a lot of people got springboarded. Robin Reed got springboarded after he beat me.
Yeah.
Lefky Keski got springboarded after he beat me. And he took that at short notice as well. And then Glenn Catley got springboarded after he beat me. Do you know what I mean? Where I'd done my best against them, but they was their best against me.
Yeah, which kind of obviously goes back to where I said at the start, really, where it's a guy with ambition probably doesn't want this, but where you have become a gatekeeper, basically.
Yeah, and the lifestyle that I was leaving, like, I wasn't that bothered because, like, money was my god then. I just cared about how much money I could get.
Yeah, so I read this. When you fought 3 months after the Catley fight, when you beat Errol MacDonald, and there's a feature that was in Boxing News at the time that said you were a landlord of a pub. That doesn't sound like the wisest career decision you have ever had. And I think, have you ever heard Barry Jones talking about this, where Barry Jones was working in a pub at the same time as he had a bit of a drink issue?
Nah, but you know what? I made a fortune at my pub. I made a fortune out of the
Old. But you also probably drank a fortune out of it.
I made a fortune out of the old sale business.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was set up for life. I'd have to work again. Do you know what I mean? I had houses abroad, houses in Turkey, houses in Bulgaria, houses in England. I had the best part of £1 million, and I'd have to work again, and I wasn't bothered. But what happened was, my addiction to drink got worse and worse. And I mean, so, you know, that's what happened.
Yeah, so is that a case of the more that you have, the worse the addiction gets?
I could never get enough of anything. I was always greedy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've got an addictive nature, and no matter how much sex I had, no matter how much money I'd got, no matter how many houses I'd got, no, I could never get enough. I was greedy. You know what I mean?
Talking about greedy, Sean Connolly, who interviewed you for Boxing News, said that you offered him a drink at the pub, and then you made him pay.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I did marry him and Gary Bate.
There were rumoured fights around this time with Brian McGee, which you mentioned, and Dean Francis.
Yeah.
Dean was a handful, wasn't he?
Yeah, but...
Had you sparred Dean?
No, I never sparred Dean, but they wouldn't give me notice.
Right.
Nobody would give me notice at that time. Do you know what I mean? I got loads of offers, but like you said earlier on, but they wanted to give me a short notice.
And then you didn't fight for a couple of years, but then came David Starry, who was a handful as well.
Yeah, David Starry's a good fighter, but I only took the fight just to put the money towards my wedding.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then when I come back and fought after when I was about 35, I was full blown, proper, 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 the, alcoholic then. I should never have come back.
So that was the Simeon go.
I should never have come back to that. I was drunk the day before. I don't know. I should never have done that. That was
tipsy drunk or drunk drunk?
Drunk drunk. That was foolish. You know what I mean? That was foolish. I was drunk, paralytic the day before that. I don't know. But I still sold lots of tickets for Errol Johnson. I mean, because when Errol Johnson was first starting going out, I used to lay him on the reins at my pub. You know what I mean? I used to put sandwiches on for the boxers and all that.
What was the hardest thing about that loss to Simeon Kova? Was it knowing that you weren't in the right state?
I was bothered, man. Because I just wore bothered. I knew it was the end.
Did you? That was my next question. Did you know that was the final straw?
Yeah, I should never have come back. I just wished I'd never have come back. To losing to somebody that you know you're better than, but that happened a lot to me. I lost to a lot of people who were as good as me. You know what I mean? But like I said, money was my god.
Well, also your 15 losses, you got 7 stoppages, but most of them were cuts. And talked about a few couple of dodgy decisions on the road as well.
Yeah, a couple of dodgy decisions. Yeah, definitely.
What was your career highlight? Was that the Terry McGee fight?
Because that was like, I got to truthfully say, I trained properly for that.
Yeah.
Because when Mike Barrett rang me up, and I was supposed to box Ian Strudwick at first.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And it was like moving into the 8-3's character category. Do you know what I mean? And I thought, well, that'll catapult me then towards the British title. But don't forget, that summer, I fought him in October, I think. The summer before that, I'd been in Corfu for 3 months, drinking, drugging it every night for 3 months, working the door, money, doing lots of stuff, criminal stuff. And I couldn't even fly back. I had to come back across Europe because I couldn't get on a plane, which is another story. But when I got back from Corfu, I started doing my road work at the end of August, right? And then I fought Terry McGee, and I really drink a lot up to that fight. You know what I mean? I trained for that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it was a good job I did, because he gave me an hard fight.
You said about having children through the, is this in the 90s?
Yeah.
How did alcohol affect your relationships, A, with children, and B, with family and dad and stuff?
My wife... At the time, June, I was with her from school, from the age of 12. Obviously, I'm divorced now because of what I did, the way I was. And family life was good. We went on lots of holidays together. I bought a few holiday homes and stuff like that. And the kids never seen me drinking like that. Or June always kept them away from me. You know what I mean? You know, and I never smacked them. I never done anything. They always said, like, as a good dad. You know what I mean? And I've done everything I could for them. We had some nice holidays, you know, together. But towards the end, I did have some horrendous holidays where I got stranded and left and broke me back and all sorts of stuff. You know what I mean? When I was with them, they did have to witness that. You know what I mean?
And how about your dad? Because obviously, you know, you started the journey together with him and it didn't pan out the way that you guys probably had hoped it was going to.
My dad... My dad didn't know what to do, to be honest. My dad thought he'd going to lose me, to be honest. Like everybody did. Everybody ripped me off, to be honest. My dad's still okay today, and we've got a really good relationship. I've been to see him this morning, and he's sad, but he's just happy that I'm happy now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You know, and Ossie Colin.
What was it? Did he try and put you under lock and key, though, to keep you in?
Yeah. He locked me in the house once. He didn't know what to do. Nobody knew what to do. You know what I mean? And he locked me in the house once. I jumped out the bedroom window. I just go and run off and get a drink. You know what I mean? I even went to court drunk once and told all the judges and everything to F off and everything. You know what I mean?
So when after you fought Kova in 2004, did things really... come unstuck then? Is that when you really...
My alcoholism was getting worse and worse then. You see, because what it is about alcoholism, it's a progressive illness.
Were you still gambling as well? Like, was there a point where you lost a lot?
Yeah. I'd done 150 grand on crack in 3 months. You know what I mean? As well. You know
what I mean? What roughly time period was that? 2000 and...
Probably about 2010.
Right.
It was horrendous. It was horrendous.
So you must have basically stayed up for 3 months.
The crowd, yeah. Well, the crack, the cocaine day have no effect on me. It started to, like, where it, like, I was, it wasn't doing anything, and it would do anything. And so then I started trying the crack, to be honest. And I'd put 100 pound rocks on and just suck it. And what I used to do, I'd buy everybody else's who was there.
Right.
Because I got money, see. I'd just have it myself, and I always shared it. You know what I mean? So we was all having like one big party. But at the same time, they were drinking and I was getting drunk as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was horrendous. I remember being on the run with it from the police once. And I went to this crack den. And I stayed in this crack den for ages. And I just got through that much money. But I don't care, like. You don't care when you're like that. When you're in addiction like that, you ain't bothered. You know what I mean? You don't care. I remember drinking my own sick once. You know, I was in a house and I was stuck in a room. I think that the Birmingham Post, Mike Lockley, done an article on me once where I drank about 14, 15 bottles of Jack Daniels in a week. And that's when I was just stuck in a room. And I was pissing and shitting myself and just waking up and just drinking. There were no fun in it. I was just addicted. If I was awake, I was drinking, I was drunk. And I remember sicking into a pint glass because I was too scared to go out and get a drink because I couldn't face nobody. And I sicked into a pint glass and drank, which was nearly pure vodka, and I drank the sick just to get a buzz.
So by this point, boxing's come and gone. I guess you haven't got a pub anymore.
No, I had to. I sold it and got rid of it.
And
But when I did get rid of it, my alcoholism spiralled. I thought I'd try and get better, but it didn't.
All through this, are there points here where you're trying to fight alcoholism as well, where you are giving up and then going back to it and thinking, oh, straighten out next week or start Monday?
But that's how it is with alcohol, with alcoholism. Like, you keep, stop, start. And I did keep trying, and I did get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did get a Bushy Fields rehab thing. I did get a sponsor. I did have counselling. I did try, I kept trying.
When did you first go to Alcoholics Anonymous?
My sister took me, because I got two sisters, and my sister took me, Bev. And
what year was that?
I can't remember, to be honest, but it was
90s or 2000s.
It was early, like I was still boxing then.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I remember sitting in my first AA meeting and thinking, well, AA is bad as these. Do you know what I mean?
Hmm.
But really, did I know I was going to be worse? Do you know what I mean? And I didn't really take no notice. I thought, I ain't like this. I don't need this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I listened to people who'd said they'd just lost everything, and then when I listened to people said they finished up in a bedsit, they finished up on a park bench, I thought, well, that ain't never going to happen to me.
You're just a recreational drinker.
You know what I mean? That ain't never going to happen to me.
Yeah.
But you know what? It did. Worse and worse. I tried to take my own life. I had that many death experiences. I got run over, I got stabbed, there's that many things.
What point did you, was suicide the option then? When what made you consider that?
Because I'd been drinking for months every day. Like, I was full blown, you know what I mean?
Drinking any other drink at all?
Anything, just alcohol. You know what I mean?
Were you even drinking beer at this point, or did you just graduate to spirits?
The spirits, the beer would have no effect, you know what I mean? And I'd lost weight and I was gone, so, you know. And the only way I used to stop, Trish, honestly, was my body would stop me. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't physically drink another drink. And that's how I used to stop, because I couldn't physically drink another drink. I tried all the medication. I tried anti-abuse tablets like George Best had sold in him. I tried them. I drank on them and I nearly died again. You know what I mean? I was that addicted. I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. Like I said, the only way I used to stop is when my body physically could not take another drink. I remember spewing pure blood out and then just drinking beer straight after. You know what I mean? And I just could not stop. And my kids witnessed that, to be honest, because I was in Tenerife. I'd fell through a roof. I'd broke my back. I don't know what brought me back, and I was walking around drunk for 2 weeks, and my missus and my kids had to go on the plane. They called an ambulance to me because I was throwing that much blood up. It was just coming out like just pure blood, proper just blood, gushing out like, do you know what I mean? And I was still drinking, and I was swearing, and I was cussing and all that, you know what I mean? And this girl, Dawn Garbutt, got me back to her apartment. My missus had to go back home on the plane. And they locked me in the apartment, and they probably saved my life.
So how's all those memories affected your kids now, years down the line?
They're okay.
Yeah, they're okay.
But, you know, they only see me being sick. Do you know what I mean? They don't really see the extent. They don't know what brought me back. I don't know what brought me back till I got back in England. Do you know what I mean? I broke my vertebrae at the bottom of my back. I don't know. I was walking around too. And the only way, when I sobered up, because that girl locked me in a room and got me a flight, then I got back to England and my back was killing me. And I went for an X-ray. And they says, right, you're one lucky man. He says, it's a wonder you ain't in a wheelchair. He says, it's just only because you're a strong lad and your training and your fitness. He says, otherwise you'd be crippled. You'd be.
So you had said about the suicide thing. Like, at what point was that rock bottom? And was that rock bottom?
That was a rock bottom. It was a cry for help, Tris, honestly.
Just nowhere to go.
I had nowhere else to go. I thought, hey, we're going to get out of this. I'd split up. I'd lost my wife then, and everything was going away from me. I wasn't seeing my children. I couldn't. I I'd been to prison. And I was still drinking. When I went to prison the first time, I thought it was a joke. Like, I just dated the notice.
What did you go for?
Just violence. You know what I mean? I got to prison. I said, if you don't give me a cell on my own, I'll beat my pad mate up. You know what I mean? That's the way I was in prison. You know what I mean? And I'd take it serious. You know? And when I come out, I got together with some lads who we'd have done some drug dealings and stuff. We went and collected the money, then we just carried on drinking and drinking and drugging it. So I'd have it, and then within no time at all, I was back in again.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? And I come out again, and that's how my life was. It was like a roller coaster. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was like a proper roller coaster.
Yeah, completely vicious circle.
Yeah.
And but by this time it's not a happy one. Like, this isn't the point in the 90s where you're enjoying it.
I wasn't.
You're actually being tortured by it.
I was in turmoil.
You're not in control of this anymore. You felt you might not have been in control, but you felt in control. But by this point, you're not in control.
It was in control of me, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop, no matter what. Like, I don't care how much willpower you've got or how much. I couldn't stop. So I remember getting all these tablets together, and I thought, am I going to get out of this? And I thought, because I just used to lie on my bed, thinking about my wife would have lost all of my reputation, like, because I went from like a local hero to a local drunk, you know what I mean? And then I was on the back page of my local paper for my boxing things, what I'd done and achieved and good, and, you know, and then I was on the front page for going to prison and all this stuff, you know, you know what I mean, which was... You know, so you know, I'd felt a long way.
Yeah, so it was a fall from grace, and you felt ashamed. And
I was ashamed. People crossing over the road and stuff like that to walk away from me and stuff. And I got a bad reputation for violence and stuff like that, and everything else. But I'd been drinking for months and months and months, and like, it does something to your brain. You're totally deluded. You're just wrecked. And I thought, the only way out of this is just to kill myself, because I can't cope. I can't cope with what I've become. I can't cope with the way I'm normal. I don't like where I was. And I hated what I'd become. And I thought, the only way out of this is death. And I decided to end it. I lied on my bed and I thought, how shall I go about it? How shall I do it? Shall I jump under a train? Shall I jump off a roof? Shall I jump off a building? Shall I throw... I was trying to work up a way to pick the best way. Like, that thought. How to do it? Do you know what I mean? And I come up with this idea where I just thought, I'm a coward. Because I'd turned into a coward then. I wore that big tough guy what used to fight everybody. I was a coward. I was a shivering wreck. Alcoholic, drunken, druggy, alcoholic mess. And I just thought, I hate my life. I hate what I am. I hate everything. I want it. I want out. And I just got enough tablets together and I just took them all. You know what I mean? Took everything. And I just passed out. You know what I mean? And that was it. I thought, that's me gone. You know what I mean?
Peace.
And I just lay on the bed and I just thought, that's it, man, I'm finished. And then I woke up in the Manor Hospital. You know what I mean? They pumped a solution into me. An ambulance was called. And they pumped a solution into me, what saved my life. But that's still good enough. You know what I mean? That's it, the crisis team. And they come to the bed and they said, there's people in here with worse problems than you. You need to pull yourself together. Do you know what I mean? But obviously I was in such a bad mess. Mm. You know what I mean? My dad was around the bed. My mum was around the bed. My sister and Angela. Like, it was in there, you know. I just got my stuff and went back out and started drinking after that. You know what I mean? And then I started it all off again. You know what I mean? And I just went missing. I just wanted to go and be left alone where I could just sit and drink.
So how did things turn around from that Andy then to the Andy that I see now? What was the, not sure if it's the right word, but what was the trigger? Where did the change come?
Well, I met this lady who I'm with now, Angela. And my mum and dad, like, took me in. I'd have been homeless if mum and dad hadn't took me in. Even though I had all these houses, I couldn't get to them. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't know fit state to do anything because I couldn't think. Do you know what I mean? Because my brain was mushy, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure.
And I was like...
Yeah, you know, all your decision making's impaired.
And I couldn't do anything, like. So I'd go back to my mum and dad's and then I'd like just stay in and recover. And I'd get to Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know what I mean? And I just go to Alcoholics Anonymous and I kept going, kept failing, kept going. And this went on for quite some time.
But, so this is the 12 steps, right?
Yeah.
And so you would get a certain way, you make some steps and then fall off again.
Yeah. And this Alcoholics Anonymous, they talked of a higher power, which for me, I only thought the higher power is God. You know what I mean? But I thought, that's a lot of rubbish.
Is that what they were referring to, the higher power?
An higher power in Alcoholics Anonymous can be anything. The meetings can be a higher power.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Or your sponsor could be. Or just something you're answerable
to.
Okay.
And I kept going to the meetings, and then I'd have some sobriety where I felt good and I'd feel okay. But you know what? It wasn't enough to stop me drinking. Do you know what I mean? And then I remember doing 6 months off the drink once, and I thought, I'm all right, I've cracked it. Do you know what I mean? And I picked one drink up to have a drink again, and it lasted a long time, months, and I nearly died again. Do you know what I mean? And that's how bad it was. Then I got back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out of hospital. I remember once having to crawl to the door because my blood pressure had gone that high. I couldn't stand up. I had to phone an ambulance. And I had all sorts of stuff like that. But I managed to get bits of sobriety here and there. And I went to a church because they talked of an higher power. And
do you think back to that Jimmy Tibbs thing at the time?
I don't think of that at the time. I don't think of anything. My head was just totally wrecked.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I kept going to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I kept trying. And I got myself a sponsor named Paul, and he'd done 20 years sober, and he was a good guy, and he really helped me a lot. And I went to this church. They talked to this higher power, so I thought, you know what, I'm going to try. And I went to this church, and I'm obviously being well-known, you know, and they knew me in the church, and this guy named John Crampton took me, like, you know, under his wing a little bit, and he made me feel welcome and stuff like that, you know. And then I carried on with AI, in and out, filing, sobriety, in and out, you know. But I kept trying. Do you know what I mean? I did.
How hard was that?
Very hard. Very hard. I'd lost my driving licence. I'd lost my heavy goods licence. I'd lost my door badge licence. I lost everything. I'd been to prison 3 times. I lost nearly everything. You know what I mean?
So what made you go back to Alcoholics Anonymous if it wasn't working? Desperation?
I had nowhere else.
Did you think, oh, well, I got 6 months before. Maybe I can do 8 months this time?
Because I'd read a Share magazine. There was a Share magazine from Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was full of good stories, people's testimonies, what had done it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? What had been where I am. And I remember coming out of prison in 2013, and because I went to the AA meetings in prison as well. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
And I went to the chapel in prison as well. Do you know what I mean? And I kept reading these Share magazines, and I kept thinking, if they can do it, I can do it. You know what I mean? They can do it, I can do it. And I kept on with AA and AA and AA, but it still wasn't strong enough. I mean, I was still addicted. I still kept failing. And every time I had a drink, it was like a breakdown. You know what I mean? Because it was, it was just one a drink, stop.
It was weeks.
It was weeks. Yeah. Or longer. And then the only way I used to stop again, like I said, was my body used to physically stop me.
So it was properly feast or famine. It was either all or nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was no...
And when I was drunk, anything could happen.
Which is what John Conte used to say, right? John Conte, when I spoke to him for the podcast, said, what was it? One drink is too much.
Yeah, and 1,000 is not enough. Somewhere. Yeah. He come to my pub, he did. I asked John, and he's in there. When I had my pub, I got him down as a guest speaker.
Yeah.
And he told me he'd been in AA for 18 years, and little did I know that I was going to end up the same way.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. He's been sober 30 odd years now.
Yeah.
It wasn't just you though, was it? There was actually a higher power for you though, right? So it wasn't just you, or you don't see it as it just a Andy Flute W alcohol. It's Andy Flute plus.
But help. I don't know what to do. I just kept on with the meetings. You know what I mean? They kept on. More meetings, more chances, more things. And I kept going. And you know what? I kept failing. You know what I mean? Then I got
the same people there all the time.
Different ones. There's different groups of meetings all around the country.
Right.
You know what I mean? And the Black Country Intergroup of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's one every day of the week. Right. Do you know what I mean? So that's what I did, because I got my sponsor and he said to me, you need to make your sobriety the most important thing in your life, nothing else, because you ain't got a life otherwise. And that stuck a chord in my head, that did.
So at what point did religion come into it?
Well, I carried on with the AA, and then I went to that church and I met John Crampton, but I still kept failing. Do you know what I mean? I still kept failing. And then I can tell you about my last drink. I still kept failing, but I'd been to the few churches trying to dip my toe in, trying to find a higher power, because I thought the only power, higher power is God, Jesus. I'd been sober for quite a while. Get back to my last drink now. And I'd been sober for quite a while. And I was feeling good. I felt okay, you know. And I went to meet Carl Froch at a sportsman's dinner. And somebody pushed a drink my way. And like a fool, as an alcoholic, you got the devil on your shoulder telling, have a drink. So I picked the drink up. And I'd been sober for a while. But it's just the addictive nature. And I did it, even though you shouldn't. But I did it. You know what I mean? And that drink lasted 2 weeks, where I was at the point of death again, because my alcoholism was worse, so you drink more, faster.
How bad were you that night then in front of Froch and that lot?
Yeah, I made a show of myself a little bit, and Angela, who I'm with now, she got me out of there, good, thanks to her, before I made a show of myself too bad. Do you know what I mean? And they got me home, they got me here. And... I was just stuck in the room, just bottle after bottle after bottle like that. Couldn't get enough. Till I pass out, till I do it again, till I pass out, till I do it again. And Angela just didn't know what to do.
So your 2 weeks runs, you stayed drinking for 2 weeks?
Solid.
And then what?
She thought I was going to die. I didn't know what to do. So I got my phone, and I phoned them people from the church to come and pray for me. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. It's no good, I don't know what to do. And because I knew I'd made friends with these people at church and I'd been talking about them.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And this guy named John and the pastor Steve, they come here. They come here. I was at death's door, man. I was. And they come and they prayed for me. Really, honestly, they prayed for me. I don't know what else to do. They prayed for me. And when they left, I dropped on my knees. And I said, God, if you are a God, if you are real. I said, if you are real. I said, and you take my addiction away from me. I said, I will follow you for the rest of my life. I will sit on the fence. I meant it with my whole heart. I meant it. And I don't know what happened. Like I had some sort of feeling. I've been told it's a spiritual awakening. I don't know what it was at the time. I never had another drink again. I never wanted a drink. Never had a drink. Never wanted a drink. Ever since that day. That day was on the 28th of October, 2015. And then on the 15th of November, John and Steve, they baptised me at Sedgley Community Church. And ever since then, my life's just gone from strength to strength. You know what I mean?
So we're hitting a 7-year mark
coming
up.
Yeah. And then I carried on with Alcoholics Anonymous because I tried to do the steps.
Yes. 12 steps.
And I kept failing because I hadn't done them right.
Yeah.
But this time, I had done them right. Step one is admit that you were powerless over alcohol. Do you know what I mean? So I'd got that done. And step two was, be conscious with God. And then I had to write an inventory out of all the people that I'd harmed and be willing to make amends. Do you know what I mean? And I did that.
So when you say harmed, do you mean like, your daughter's on the flight and
because of you,
or do you mean not, like
from back in the day and stuff like that? People who had.
So it's quite a long list.
Yeah, yeah, but I did it honestly and I did it correctly. And you know what? I had a spiritual awakening while I did it. You know what I mean? Like my sponsor said to me, he said, "God has just touched you, ain't he?" And I said, "Who did you know?" He said, "I seen he." He said, "Andy," he said, "God's just forgiven you for everything you've done." Do you know what I mean? And I went, "Wow." I said, "What was that?" He went, I said, "How did you see that?" He said, "I knew." And it was like it come up from my belly all the way through. And I felt like a euphoric feeling, like a rush. I don't know what it was at the time. And then on step 12, it says, having had a spiritual awakening of doing the steps correctly. Do you know what I mean? And I'm set free. I don't even get an urge for a drink today. I've got a different life today.
What about gambling?
I don't do nothing like I have an odd punt here and there, but see, the Bible says gambling is not a sin, but the love of money is a sin. Do you know what I mean? And the greed. You know what I mean? So, I've got a good life today. People don't believe me all the time when I say, "Don't you get an urge for a drink?" Because they know how bad an alcoholic I was.
Yeah.
And I said, "No, God's totally removed you."
Are you still around any of your old friends from back in the day?
I've just totally changed all my friends. The ones I used to do the criminal activities with, I no longer have nothing to do with them. They can't believe you, to be honest. They can't believe you. I still know that they're out there. They're still doing what they do. I couldn't even steal a pen these days. I couldn't do anything.
And how about the boxing community? How are you with the people that we've talked about? Sparring partners, opponents, the rest.
I'm still in touch with Joe Kozaki. He wrote in my book for me.
Oh, yeah. So you and Joe. So tell me, we haven't touched upon this yet. So when were you sparring with Joe?
I went to spar with Joe in Newbridge.
In the old shed, Jim?
In the old shed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went down on my own. good, Joe, and his dad. They made me feel really welcome, and I met his mum and all that. Yeah, it was good. It was odd. It was really odd. Spoiling me, Joe. Really odd. He's very awkward. You know what I mean?
Volume, but, speed.
Yeah. You could get out of the way of his shots.
And
man.
Power, right?
Underrated power. Mate. But I've put it in my book that he's the best one out of the lot anyway. You know what I mean? I'll rate him better than anybody else I've sparred with.
Well, Nigel Benn, you know, when I did the podcast with Nigel, he said that, because I said, how would Joe have done in your era? And he said he would have cleaned us all out.
I mean, they've all got different strengths, different, good at different things.
Yeah, for sure.
But I believe Joe's hand speed and his southpaw stance, and he could eat as well. Do you know what I mean? I think he was the best. You know.
By the way, obviously we see this, two things. One, did you see the eccentric side of Chris Eubank, or was he just...
I spoke with him recently, you know, because, you know Spencer Brown? Do you know Spencer Brown?
Yeah, from Goldstar.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work with him in the past, you know what I mean? I've put a lot of shows on with him, and I've done a lot of stuff with him. And when I've done my exhibition fight with Nigel, I've done it with Spencer. He done a tour, didn't he, with Nigel and...
Oh, yeah, I see. They're doing another one. They asked me to go. Yeah.
And I went. And I met Chris and stuff, and it was good.
Was he eccentric back in the day, and did you see or...
Yeah, because when Barry Ayne come to watch me spar, right, Chris Day throw a punch, he stood back. Do you know what I mean? And Barry's there, come to watch, and Chris just stood back. You know what I mean? But I couldn't knock him. He treated me with respect, and I got on great with him.
And also, I know obviously you were a handful yourself, but Chris, when we talked about Joe being an underrated fighter, period, Chris had underrated toughness as well, because everyone saw the show pony and thought that he was
all flash, but
there was a lot of substance.
Chris was tough, man. Chris was tougher than Nigel and tougher than anybody else as well. You know what I mean? Henry Wharton was tough as well. I mean, Henry Wharton was a tough guy as well.
When was the last time you saw Henry?
I ain't seen him for a few years, to be honest. I know his gym's going all right and stuff like that, because I'm still in touch with Gary Adkin.
But
Chris is probably the toughest out of the lot, to be honest.
Which isn't a bad claim to fame, is it, out of that lot? Is there anyone that... I suppose you did mention Harold Graham there, but was he... You said you didn't really have trouble with anyone, but if there was someone that people had trouble with, it was generally Harold Graham.
I never had no problem with Harold Graham, because he was coming towards the end of his career,
right?
Obviously, and I just kept on top of him. I didn't give him a chance to settle.
Kept the pressure on.
You know what I mean? Yeah, you know. And he was towards the end anyway. You know what I mean? But I had no problem with him. You know what I mean? When I needed a break, I just stepped back. You know what I mean? Let's keep out of distance, you know what I mean? And then put it close to him, you know what I mean?
You know, I've written this book, Damage, recently, right? Which is about CTE and long-term brain injuries through boxing. There are some voices in there, when I speak to George Foreman and the late Ernie Shavers, that say they felt that they were well-preserved into old age because they lived the life and didn't really take a drink.
Yeah, well.
Do you have apprehension about your mileage when you talk about the tough spars, the hard fights, and the drink and drugs? Do you have concern about your...
I don't worry about all that. It took me 2 years for my brain to go right first, because like for the first year of being sober and clean off drink and drugs, the first year the lights was on but there were nobody in,
just in a cloud.
But I've got liver damage, kidney damage, disease, all that's gone now. I'm clear. You know what I mean? But I don't worry about it. You look at like Raging Bull, Jake LaMotta and stuff like that. He lived till a good old age, and he took a lot of punishment as well. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So it's just whatever your genes are, I think. I don't think it's worth worrying anyway. Plus, I believe God has healed me anyway. You know what I mean? So, you know, I don't worry about things like that. I don't look too far forward.
So, looking back, you know, like I said at the top, really, your career could have been is in many ways a what if, but it's not really about that, is it now? Because your story's more than just your career. Like, your life story is about redemption. And
well, it's about helping others. It's because other people, I've got a ministry, but I go around the country and I talk in rehabs, I talk in churches, I talk in all sorts of places. And I believe I was saved for this purpose, not to be a world champion. I was saved to do what I'm doing now. I bought lots and lots of people from, I mean, I've had people, mothers, fathers, buy their book for the kids and stuff, and they've come off drink, come off drugs, they've changed their life and stuff like that. And that's far more rewarding than anything else for me. When I do an altar call, in the churches and stuff, does anybody want to give their life to Christ? And they go, yeah, me. That's more rewarding than any fight I've ever had. And when people say, my son's come off drinking because he's read your book, that's more rewarding. You know,
winning a world title.
Yeah, than anything else.
And when you talk about, by the way, that bit where you make the pact with God and say that you will serve him for the rest of your life, that's you completely surrendering, isn't it? Not you half-hearted, that's you saying,
well, that's the reason why
I'm
free today, you know what I mean?
Because you have surrendered.
Because I surrendered. I did surrender. And it says you in the Bible, Hebrews 12, if God wants to use you, he will discipline you first. And Jimmy Tibbs said God would use me, but he disciplined me to make me righteous so he could use me. Now, if I want to think, oh, I'm all right now, I'll go back to that hard life, I'd be kidding myself. Do you know what I mean? If I still think that I could steal and rob and do all that, I'd end up, worse off than I was before, because Jesus won't die twice for you. Do you know what I mean?
So there must be a bit, and this is a double-edged sword, right? So I'm playing devil's advocate here. There must be a bit with you where you're at now in life that is remorseful and regretful for the stuff that you did, even though it's made you what you are today.
I'm not remorseful. God's forgiven me. I know I am remorseful. I did what I did, and I learnt what I learnt, and that's what's part of my journey, is to be able to help others. Do you know what I mean? But when somebody listens to me and I stand up in a prison, I go, I've done this, I've done this, I've done that, I've done this, but this is who I am now. They listen. You know what I mean? And I know God's forgiven me.
How about this? If you could do it all again, would you do it differently?
I'd do my boxing differently, yeah. And I wish I would have found Christ earlier, because I wish I wouldn't have had to go to the depths that I went to. I wish I would have gone to God earlier, because it's a far better life than the things of the world and living in the flesh and the lust of greed and love of money and all the stuff. Because I always loved money too much, and it made me do things that I shouldn't do. You know what I mean? I wish I would have found God earlier. That's my only thing. The boxing and all the things and everything else and all the stuff, it's just, that ain't as rewarding as knowing God, to be honest.
Good. There's some heavy stuff in there, but I've enjoyed this, Andy, and I'm glad we managed to finally get it done. And we've been talking about it on and off for a long period of time, but it was kind of everything I expected, and then a little bit more. So
And my book as well, I written my book, right? I don't write to sit down and say, I'm going to write a book. I sat down, Angela, and bought me a journal, and I said, why don't you just start writing some of the names you've been in the ring with to try and give me therapy?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I was that bad. And I read that book with a pen and paper. No ghostwriter, nothing. And I got my cousin to put it on an email, put it in, because I call spell, spelling right, put it into Microsoft Word, and I sent it to about five or six publishers. Well, they did, and they all wanted it, and it's been a great success. And I'm just so blessed just to have a book with the name of Jesus on it. And I'm so blessed to have a book, and I'm so glad just to wake up free of not wanting a drink.
And it's out on Amazon and all good books.
It's out on Amazon. I've just done audio books for it, which will be on Amazon as well. But just to wake up and not want to drink, Trist, is amazing. You know what I mean? Just to be set free from that. And the book about how good a boxer I was, because I wasn't, but the book's about what God did for me. You know what I mean? It's as simple as that. You know what I mean?
Brilliant, Andy. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. It's nice to finally get it done. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
So thanks so much to Andy for sharing his story and for having me as a guest. He's a very interesting man, and I wish him all the best in his recovery. His biggest fight was outside of the ring, and he has won it. I hope he keeps on enjoying the life he's living. A huge thanks to my sponsors at Hanson Lee Resourcing. That's Blaz and the gang, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide.
They provide expert and impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out about Dell and the gang at delcosafety.co.uk. And we'll be back next week.